You're listening to Intellectual Erection,
a place where we talk about the naughty.
Just stimulate your thinking.
You're listening
to
Intellectual Erection.
Intellectual Erection.
Передачу, где мы говорим о диспуте там, субъекты секса.
Hablamos de los sexos.
В компаниях, но мы говорим о
информации. Мы говорим о дефибюдне.
To stimulate your thinking.
Welcome back to Intellectual Erection. I'm your host, Patrick, and today I'm speaking with Mia Schachter.
I swear to fucking God, this dude reached around and tried to stick a dry finger up my asshole.
Mia works in film and television as an intimacy coordinator. What exactly that is, we're going to talk about. It's basically setting up sex scenes and making sure that that intimacy looks real and is consensual between the actors. We also talk about how the emergence of a job like an intimacy coordinator might intersect with the Me Too era and what that means. Before we get on to the episode, I'd like to say thank you to everyone who's participated and submitted sexy stories for the anonymous Sexy Tales episodes that I've been compiling, and I am still indeed accepting sexy stories. I have some in the bank right now. I need a few more to compile another episode, so please go ahead, send me your sexiest stories, record it on your phone, and send it to intellectualerection@gmail.com. You will be anonymous, and you will be included in a future episode. Also, your story might end up being illustrated by Kurt Montgomery or myself. So send them in. And as always, listen, subscribe, review, and most of all, enjoy. I'm sitting here today with
Mia Schachter.
Hi, Mia.
Hi.
Welcome to my second ever Zoom interview.
Thank you.
All the way from
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. You must be one of my most distant interviews. Well, last time I did Vancouver, which is the same time difference. That's pretty funny.
Right.
So why don't we tell the listeners what it is that you do?
Okay. So I'm an intimacy coordinator for TV and film, which means that I'm much like a stunt coordinator. I'm there to make scenes look real and stay safe. But the content that I work with is simulated sex and nudity and content that relates to eroticism and those themes.
Oh, this is so exciting. I didn't even know this job existed. And now that I do, it makes sense. And there's a lot of really cool questions around, you know, that type of work. So I can't wait to dig into it. But first things first, there is something that I ask all of my guests, which is the origin question. It's a two-parter. The first part, you can choose not to answer if you like. And then the second part is just really how you got into this line of work, which I kind of label as sex positive. The first question is, I'm always curious, the first encounter that people have had with sex or sexuality when they were kids and when they didn't know what it was, and what that experience was like. And I'll usually get some kind of story about, you know, encountering it in media or seeing something and not quite understanding it. And I'm always fascinated with that first encounter with the sexual.
Hmm.
If you'd like to share. If not, we can.
Well, the first thing that's coming to mind is not media. It's just, it was just like the first time that I remember feeling any kind of sexual feeling. And I think I was like 9 years old or so, and I was sitting in the back of a car, alone. My babysitter was driving the car, and I was wearing jeans, and I just remember kind of like shifting in the seat and being like, oh, what is that? And feeling like it was new. I remember thinking, this is like a new feeling. And I don't really know what it is. But I also remember thinking like, I shouldn't be doing this right now. Like that I felt it and I kind of noted it. And then I was like, this isn't something that I should explore right now. But that's all I really remember about it. It's just this kind of glimpse.
That's the funny thing is that most people that I ask this question toward, they mention something about the first instance being a bit of a surprise, but also immediately being coupled with a sense of taboo and perhaps shame. Like,
yeah,
not something that you're supposed to talk about, experience, share. And I've had very few cases where people had their first sort of encounter with the sexual not be shrouded with some sense of guilt. So this is kind of why I asked that question, is I'm just curious how embedded these sort of social standards are towards sex and sexuality that the majority of us experience our first encounter with the sexual as being taboo, which I also suspect somehow leads to the kinks and fetishes.
Right, right. Well, I remember this moment just sort of thinking like, this isn't something that I should do like with, you know, around other people, that this is like private.
So the second part of the origin question then is how you became involved with what I like to call the sex positive communities, which involves everything from sex work, polyamory, kink, BDSM, sex education. More specifically, in your case, it'll be your work. But I also don't know that much about you. So take me on a journey.
Okay. All right. The origin story, you know, I have like a professional origin story, but I think that what you're getting at is more personal, like what my, where my interest came from and that sort of background. So I'll start there. I was interested in sex and sexuality and gender from high school, starting in high school. And I don't think I had the language at the time, you know, this was like 15 or 16 years ago. So at the time, I just didn't really have an awareness about this stuff as even like something that could define a community. I didn't know how to look for it. And I didn't know, I didn't really have the vocabulary. This was like pre-Tumblr. So I was always interested in those themes. And I actually, you know what? It may even start before that. When I was 8 years old, my parents played the Rent soundtrack in the car. And I was obsessed with it. I was 8 years old. And, you know, whether or not that was appropriate is a different question. But I know that whole album, like front to back, word for word. And the themes in that show around sex and sexuality, gender fluidity, addiction, mental health, like those are themes that have stayed with me throughout my life. And it's kind of a chicken and egg type of question. Like, am I interested in that stuff because of Rent, or did Rent speak to me on a deep level because somehow I was already kind of pre-wired to be interested in those things? And I think it's probably a combination.
It takes a certain kind of person and a certain kind of exposure.
Exactly. But then when I was in college, I was trying to choose a major and I took this philosophy and feminism class. And that really kind of busted open my awareness of like the history of this stuff and the language and the critical theory around it. And I ended up majoring in philosophy, but kind of had this really heavy lean into identity. And then kind of extracurricularly was continuing my studies in sex and sexuality, gender, power dynamics, relationships. I was always kind of, and I'm sure you hear this a lot, but I was always kind of the person that like friends would come to and, you know, ask about like sex questions and relationship stuff. And I think I had a way of kind of talking about stuff that made people uncomfortable with just, you know, this like casualness and like informality. So then the way that I fell into this work, I started to work in other art mediums. I was doing theater. And so the themes that I was always interested in were these same themes. They kept coming up. And then I started writing my own plays and those themes were still coming up. And then I kind of rejected theater for a while due to some kind of traumatic experiences I had with huge egos and one particular creep in the theater. And then went into visual art. I started doing ceramics and I sent you some pictures of the sex toys that I made. So again, like those themes were coming up. And then I started doing more kind of fine art and performance work and still like trauma, the body, sex, all that stuff was just like inescapably there. And then I moved home to Los Angeles about 2 years ago, thinking I would write for TV. And I started writing a movie with a friend, a romantic comedy about a sex choreographer. And we thought, like, we didn't know for sure that this was a job, but we thought this must be a job, right? Like, how could this not be a job? And then almost immediately, these articles and interviews started coming out about this woman, Alicia Rodas, who was the first intimacy coordinator. And we realized we had to completely, like, overhaul this script. We needed to do a lot of research about what this job was, because it was suddenly really, really, like, of this moment. Shortly after that, I got a job as a casting assistant on The Affair, and we hired an intimacy coordinator. So when I heard about that, I reached out to her and said, can I interview you, because I'm writing this movie? And then at the end of the interview, I just said, you know, are you training people? Like, this is a job that is just the nexus of, like, all my different interests. My plan B kind of for my life, if I didn't make it as an artist or a playwright or a writer, was to become a sex educator. And this job just sort of, like, landed in my lap as, you know, you don't really have to make a choice, which is kind of how I've made a lot of decisions. Like, how can I get out of making a choice? Okay, I'll just do everything.
So yeah. I guess you've managed to somehow find that really strange and weird crossroad that I didn't even know existed until you reached out to me to tell me there's a job called intimacy coordinator.
I haven't really thought about, you know, the way that we perform identity, and how, like, that is actually a huge part of my job, is, like, helping people kind of identify the ways that, you know, a character might not just, like, have sex with this person and serve the story in that way, but, like, what does it mean, you know, who is this person sexually?
Right. So your job is basically to find the intimate links between the characters and then have the actors work around that. Plus, I think what I understood from your bio is also things involving consent and boundaries, which you do teach classes on, which is also part of your intimacy coordination job, right?
It's not. It's a separate thing that I started doing because I really saw this need for it. You know, intimacy coordinators at this point are not required anywhere except at HBO. And so, you know, we're an additional line item to a budget. So what I was, I started to get sort of, you know, like, a bit concerned that if there are people who have a personal history of trauma or aren't so solid on their own boundaries or don't know how to even identify what it feels like to hit a boundary, you know, if they walk onto a set without an intimacy coordinator, like, they may not even know what's within their rights. And so I developed a workshop for actors and directors that helps people get really in touch with those feelings. Actors, of course, are really quick to learn this stuff. Like, they, you know, they're so in touch with their feelings, and I don't just mean their emotions, but, like, the embodied sense, like, what it feels like viscerally. So those workshops are, I love teaching those workshops. I find them so gratifying, and the feedback that I get is that they're so impactful, that's, like, a huge, you know, something that really gives me a lot of personal satisfaction. And now that we are social distancing, I've been doing them over Zoom and opened them up to beyond just people in the entertainment industry. So I now teach them every weekend. I offer 4 different classes, and we go over different consent frameworks. And then I also do that privately. I actually offer, like, one-on-one guidance and kind of feeling into those boundaries and pulling apart the really kind of getting really nitty gritty with, like, language. And also, are you familiar with the word prosody?
I've heard it before, and right now it's not coming.
Well, I can define it for the listeners either way. So it's all the aspects of language, of speech, aside from language. So it's going to be things like tone of voice, vocal fry, you know, pitch, volume, speed, something called chunking, which is, like, how you like group words and then where you pause, upspeaks, like if you, you know, if you end every thought going up like this. Those are all things that communicate your emotional state to other people. And they also, it also communicates confidence and security. So when someone, and it's really, of course, very useful for actors and impressions and things like that. But when it comes to consent and boundaries, we can identify how solid someone is in their own boundaries, how certain they are of their own boundaries, based on their prosody. And what happens a lot is, like, if someone doesn't sound very secure in their boundary, other people see that as an indicator that they can push a little bit. So something that I work on with my clients is, your body language and the way that you're going to state your boundaries so that you're not inviting people to kind of push you because you say it with such firmness and groundedness.
This is, I think, very important work. I started this podcast literally because it was meant to be an academic project where I interviewed people in the sex positive communities about nonverbal consent.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I felt it needed to be theorized because so much of us get away with nonverbal consent, and a lot of shitty behaviors happens at that exact level, where we pretend like we're unable to read things like body language.
Yes.
And like you said, prosody, which I should have remembered because I used to teach communications. And once you start talking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, duh.
I am.
But yeah, so yeah, tone of voice, confidence, wavering, pauses, right? All these sorts of things we're able to read. Either consciously or even unconsciously, but we get a tone, we get an idea of what the other person, whether they're interested or not, unless we're intoxicated. But most of the time, if somebody's facing away from you while you're talking to them and doesn't make eye contact, doesn't face you, doesn't smile, doesn't like show any sort of like welcoming gestures, that in itself should be enough of a sign for you to back away.
Right.
And some people don't because they know that they can bully that person or intimidate them with a larger presence. So I think the work that you're doing is very important, especially to train the people who are vulnerable to being exploited by others who use those types of tactics. And the fact that you do it in the entertainment industry, I think, is doubly important because we have so many stories since the Me Too era of the type of sexual exploitation that happens in media behind the scenes, right?
Right.
So we don't have to list all the examples, but, you know, from Roman Polanski to Weinstein to all these shitty things that happen. And even something as simple as getting an actor to consent to nudity because they're unknown, right?
Right.
Which we know has happened in some shows where first season of show A, you see many of the main cast nude. And then second season, as soon as they become popular and they're no longer expendable, now they get the right to voice their no.
Right.
And the consent was always there. It's just that the power dynamics have changed. So being able to kind of, for you to identify those negotiations, those boundaries, and that type of consent within media, I think is timely and important.
Yeah. I want to just also offer this thought because I want to make sure that when people don't know what this job is, that they don't think that I'm only there to like prevent trauma.
Right.
Because even on like a perfect set, there's a power dynamic and that's just the way that it is. And I don't think that that's a bad thing. Like, you know, there's the creative team. The actors are not at the top of the power dynamic, most of the time. And so it's really hard in a power dynamic to feel into your own boundaries and what you're comfortable with. And it's also sometimes, even for people who are typically really good at saying no, when you have to make all these considerations, like when you have to just figure out, you know, am I comfortable showing the side of my chest? Am I comfortable showing, you know, my butt from the side, but not from like the just straight on from the back. Like being able to kind of get into those details is a big part of my job. And also helping actors communicate their boundaries to each other and then making sure that we kind of stay within those boundaries as we go. Not because I'm trying to make sure that no one does anything wrong. Like I'm not there to, you know, police the scene or the situation, but rather to help it flow smoothly. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable having these conversations. And that includes like makeup people and costume people. And lots are really comfortable with it, but plenty aren't. And so what happens is that, you know, this content naturally for me gets prioritized in my brain. And I think that's why this job made so much sense to me, was because this is the kind of stuff that I like soak up and think of first and foremost. Whereas if you're a costumer or a costume designer, you may not, this probably isn't the kind of information that like, that, you know, that you mull over day in and day out. And so I'm there to make sure that, because it's my priority, I'm there to make sure that the communication around this content is flowing smoothly and not getting kind of lost in anywhere in the chain.
So it sounds like the sort of social task that you took upon yourself, or that people kind of allotted to you when you were in college, namely being this sort of medium for sexual discourse, is now something that you've been able to turn into a job in a place where, yeah, like you said, the power dynamics do exist there, and that's not something that can necessarily change, and it's not a good or a bad thing, but it's important to recognize them so that we can have a type of discourse that that can create appropriate boundaries between those different hierarchical powers.
Yeah.
And now to get to the more positive end of things of your job, I think there's a lot of probably exciting things that go on behind the scenes. So I wanted to get an idea of how you approach a scene and mention all, you can name drop everything you like, you know, to make a scene intimate between actors. I'm sure.
Sure. Well, the biggest thing that I've found that helps get these scenes kind of done efficiently is that conversation between the actors about what they're comfortable with. Because it's, you know, if I'm having a conversation with an actor one-on-one and I say, you know, are you comfortable being touched on your chest? Are you comfortable being touched on your butt, on your waist? Are you comfortable being squeezed? Are you comfortable being like, you know, having like feathering touch? And you know, they'll say I'm ticklish. So like feathering probably isn't okay. I'm okay with squeezing, maybe not scratching. So we get really, really detailed about that. But then if I relay that to another actor, that's not, it's much less impactful than it is if I direct the actors through their own conversation about it, so that someone is saying to another person, you can do this, you can touch me here, you can squeeze this hard, okay, let me show you on your arm, this is how hard you can squeeze my butt, things like that. You know, can I kiss you on the neck? Yes. Maybe no tongue on my neck. Like those conversations, I've seen like hours allotted to shoot a scene, and then after we have that conversation and block it, we nail it in the first take, and then we've done like a second for safety, just to have a second option. As opposed to what I think has historically happened most of the time, which is like, just roll and we'll figure it out as we go. Because, you know, we give actors lines, we tell them what to say, but as soon as it's a sex scene, we're like, you figure it out.
Yeah. And it's improvisation time.
Exactly. Exactly.
We'll just film it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just go for it. Just try something. And it can be really nerve-wracking, because most of the time people don't want to make anyone uncomfortable or do anything that would push their boundaries. But if they don't know what they are, then it really restricts what they're willing to try to in an improvisation. So if you give people kind of like a menu, you know, you can touch me here in this way, you can touch me here in this way. Like if there's a menu, and then everything else that's not on the menu is not on the table, it frees people up to really explore within those those boundaries or restraints. So if you're looking for a specific story, well, I'll tell you one of kind of getting into boundaries with somebody. So I was working on a show and there was an actor who it was his first, not even his first job, it was his first audition and he got the job. And the way that it works on a set is that most of the time with a guest star or a day player, or, you know, someone who's just in one episode, they will, if there's a sex scene, they'll shoot the sex scene first, in case the actors don't get along so that they don't then work together and then have to do the sex scene at the end. They kind of get it out of the way, which is, you know, strange, but I see what the thinking is behind that. So he had to do his first scene on his first day with the lead, and she's a big star. And so he did that, and it was, it went really well. You know, very quickly I was like, how are you doing with this? And he was like, honestly, I was like so nervous, but you know, it's just work. Like it's just, I'm just at work, I guess. And we kind of, you know, we laughed about it. He was fine. And he had told me at the beginning, I'm totally comfortable with full rear nudity. He actually said, my ass is hilarious. So use it as much as you want. And I was like, that's fantastic.
My ass is hilarious.
Yeah. Great. So then, there was a second episode where he was doing a sex scene and the director had brought up the idea of doing some inserts, like close-up shots. And one of them was like a hand on his butt, like a close-up on his butt. And it was just an idea that was tossed out there. So I asked him, I was like, how does this sound to you? And he did this very like, I don't know about a close-up. I don't know about that. And I was like, okay, no problem. And he was like, well, are they going to be disappointed? Like, is that going to ruin the scene? Like, I don't know why. I don't know why I'm comfortable with a wide shot of my butt, but not a close up. And I was like, it's not going to ruin the scene at all. It was just an idea that was thrown out. It sounds like this is a no for you and you don't need to, you know, you don't need to explain. And he just was like, well, I really don't want anyone to feel like I'm being difficult. And then he started to just like talk himself out of the no. So yeah. That's like a train of thought that I know immediately is like, that's a no. When someone has a no, and then they try to talk themselves out of it. Like, maybe I'm only uncomfortable with it because of this. Like, I don't know why it's any different. You know, a wide versus a close. Like, it doesn't matter. You feel different about it. It doesn't need to be. You don't need to have a logical reason. And so we didn't do it, and it was fine. But that was a really clear example of like. Of that power dynamic at play, where I think that had the director, who was a wonderful, kind, you know, compassionate director who didn't want anyone to do anything that they were uncomfortable with at all. But had she asked him herself, he might have felt pressured to say yes, even though she wouldn't have wanted to had she known how much that he was uncomfortable. You know, that's where like no one wants anyone to be uncomfortable, and yet it's unavoidable. And that's why bringing in a neutral third party, you know, I'm not invested in like the story or the final product the same way that a director or a writer is. I'm invested in making sure that people are comfortable.
So it sounds to me like you create positive intimacy by opening up a menu of options of what people are comfortable doing so that they can engage in those more freely without the sort of awkward hiccups of the work that's involved in the scene and working with a relative stranger, especially since the sex scenes are done first for obvious reasons that you mm-hmm. mentioned. And then you're also there to prevent people from crossing their own boundaries willingly or unwillingly or unknowingly.
Yeah.
So this makes me wonder, do you think that this type of job of intimacy coordination that you kind of came across has been a product of the Me Too era? And because of the type of exploitation that has happened in media in the past, Do you think that's what made something like this job emerge? Because it seems like you are there on set to prevent future instances of sexual mm-hmm. exploitation, boundary crossing, sexual harassment, discomfort, mm-hmm. right, for crew and performers.
Yeah, that's a somewhat complicated question. So the Me Too movement was going on for years and years before that Harvey Weinstein article came out. It was started by a woman named Tarana Burke, so a Black woman, and it kind of got washed out by white women in Hollywood because as it stood at the time and probably largely still stands, those were the most powerful women whose stories were able to actually overturn Harvey Weinstein's power. And that's when the Me Too movement kind of blew up to a nationally known scale. So intimacy coordination was brewing. Intimacy direction is what it's called in the theater. And that's been going on since 2007 or even before. But kind of silently and under the radar, it wasn't really being talked about super widely. And intimacy coordination for TV was brewing before that article came out. So the way that I see it, the environment and the environment that made the Me Too movement kind of shoot up the way that it did is the same environment that necessitated and generated and kind of bred intimacy coordination. And then I think that as soon as that article came out in October of 2017, and then after that with just the wake of that huge wave, intimacy coordination became kind of this go-to thing that everyone could point to as like, this is a really clear thing that we can do, both proactively and retroactively, to kind of mediate the power dynamics on set, remedy certain things that have gone wrong, make sure that we have accountability and responsibility. And it just, I think that huge burst to the Me Too movement made intimacy coordination kind of seem like just this really necessary, obvious thing to do. And then it did get a lot of press very quickly, I think, because of that wave.
So you're seeing it more as a sort of intimacy coordination and the Me Too movement coming out of a sort of paradigm.
Yeah.
Where, because that's why I called it more like a Me Too era.
Yeah.
I know it began around 2006 with Burke, but didn't gain popularity until, like you said, white women came out and forward, which has been the case in many historical instances of activism.
Right.
So it seems like they were kind of simultaneous with the theater and then this article coming out. But then as the popularity of the Me Too movement gained steam, so did the importance of this job, it seems. Yeah. Do you think that now there's going to be more of these jobs opening up outside of HBO? You mentioned earlier that HBO seems to be the only production company that's kind of employing intimacy coordinators outside the theater.
Oh, no. HBO is the only network that requires an intimacy coordinator anytime there's a closed set, which is nudity or simulated sex, and sometimes other instances of intimacy. But lots of other networks are using and hiring intimacy coordinators. We're just not required by any other network yet. I do think that there are some networks that are probably headed that way. And of course, everything is kind of stalled right now in terms of making those decisions. But there's also certain production companies and certain directors who've said, I will always use an intimacy coordinator now, whether or not we're partnering with a network that requires it. I know that like Lena Waithe's production company, if they haven't stated that, they are using us a lot and have said that they will use intimacy coordinators moving forward.
Now it sounds like a matter of liability.
Right. There's also a part of this job where like we are there to protect the network. The network having a designated person to make sure that we stay within the nudity and simulated sex riders to the contracts, you know, making sure that the script supervisor knows, like, hey, we have to cut around this little blip because we're not allowed to show nipple or butt crack or whatever it is, and then making sure that that information gets to the post team. Yeah, that certainly does protect the network. We're not a fail safe, you know, like harassment happens. We're not HR, we're not inspectors for the network. So we're not, we are not a fail safe, you know, prevention method. But I do find that having an intimacy coordinator around seems to put people kind of on their best behavior.
By fail safe, do you mean that it doesn't completely reduce liability so that people involved in these scenes still have their rights to be able to come back and, you know, perhaps challenge something with regards to consent or how their scene was used?
Oh, no, I mean more along the lines of, like, you know, there are shitty people who are going to harass people whether or not there's an intimacy coordinator present, you know, like that's going to happen. That having an intimacy coordinator there doesn't prevent people from being shitty.
Well, my question about that was whether if somebody is shitty at that point, just because a production company had an intimacy coordinator and ticked off certain boxes, doesn't mean that that harassment is now sort of covered over by these check marks. I don't know if I'm explaining myself.
No. Oh yeah. No, I know what you're saying.
Somebody can still basically say I was harassed and pursue some sort of legal action if they needed to.
Yes. And the network can't say, like, well, we hired an intimacy coordinator, so we aren't responsible for this and you can't sue us. Yeah, no, certainly. And, you know, we are not, we can sort of help, people, like, guide people in the right direction if they want to report something, but, like, people shouldn't be reporting sexual harassment to us. Like, you wouldn't have a stunt coordinator on set who then, you know, if someone sees, like, if someone trips and falls, like, the network is like, well, we had a stunt coordinator, so, you know, like, it's sort of a parallel there.
So then I want to ask, are you allowed to talk about the shows that you've worked on and give us a little bit of spiel about where you've worked, what you've done? Or
I can tell you what I've worked on. I would be hesitant to share, like, specific stories with names and stuff. But yeah, I can certainly tell you, like, my credits.
That's on
IMDb. Okay, so the first show that I ever worked on was Euphoria on HBO, and I took the woman who started as the intimacy coordinator on that show was Amanda Blumenthal. She trained me. She's that person that I interviewed and then offered to train me. And she was their intimacy coordinator for almost the entirety of that shoot, and that shoot got extended so many times. And in the end, she had to leave like 2 or 3 weeks early. So I took over on that show. I shadowed on that show. I really learned the ropes from her on that show. I worked on Perry Mason for HBO, which is coming out soon. I worked on the fourth season of Insecure. I worked on Lena Waithe's show 20s. And I've done some short films. I've worked on Grey's Anatomy, Station 19, Love, Simon, Party of Five, For All Mankind, Interrogation. I'm sure I'm missing a few.
It's hard to remember without the list in front of you.
It is. But those are the ones that are coming to mind most readily. And then I've worked on some short films. I haven't done any movies yet. It's kind of strange. Movies are not quite yet on board with intimacy coordination. I'm not totally clear on why that is, but like, I know that Netflix has hired some intimacy coordinators for their movies, but, like, you know, big movies are not quite yet really using us yet.
Do you think that's going to change in the future?
I think so, and I hope so. I mean, my guess is that as more people work with intimacy coordinators, more people will start to request us, and it will start to seem strange if you don't have one, you know. Right now, there's still a bit of there's a lot of resistance to this job in the industry and it mostly comes from just kind of a misunderstanding. There's like one of maybe five things that people think that we are before they really know. They think that we're an on-set therapist or social worker. They think that we're HR. Some directors are afraid, seem to be afraid that we're going to kind of like neuter the scene or start trying to direct it. We don't talk to actors about character development or their internal emotional lives or subtext or anything like that. We really strictly talk to them about boundaries and what they're comfortable with, and then movement. So we can choreograph if that's wanted. And I think a lot of directors end up doing their own choreography. And so I think a lot of the time people hear what we do and they think, oh, well, I don't need one of those. Like, I do my own choreography. And I try to remind people, like, even if I went to go direct something, even if I wrote a script and directed my own script and there was a sex scene, I would need to hire an intimacy coordinator who was not myself, because I am now in a position of power over the actors. People also think that we're like the PC police. I've had people apologize to me for cursing just like as though I'm like the babysitter. So I do think that there's kind of some misconceptions that are preventing this job from really, you know, just like breaking that dam and being seen as like just a super obvious, helpful thing and not an impediment to the process.
Yeah, I can totally understand from the perspective of the production company or the director saying, oh, here's another thing that I now have to pay for, a service that I have to pay for and deal with a few more obstacles to, you know, creating my vision, blah, 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 and potentially having like PC police around coordinating my scenes and telling my actors what they, you know, can, can't, or don't want to do. And they might not see the value in it immediately, or they might be afraid that it might lose some of the organic chemistry that can happen in a sex scene if it's improvised.
Yes.
Or whatever shit like that. So I think you're probably right when you say that they're not immediately seeing the value and the emerging sort of importance of this kind of job on set.
Yeah.
And I think once it's properly advocated for and the value of it is seen, it's going to become one of those things that are indispensable. It's like, oh yeah, we need this, and it's going to be part of the set. It's going to be part of the set list of like, here's what we need. We need this, 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 intimacy coordinator, of course, and this and that, provided that we have some sort of intimate scenes. So beyond intimacy coordination and the classes that you teach, you also have a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Absolutely. You do a lot. Again,
yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your podcast, how long you've been doing it, and how that maybe intersects with some of the other stuff that you do.
Yeah, okay. So that podcast, my podcast is called Share the Load. And it's about the division of labor in relationships. So that's all kinds of labor in all kinds of relationships. And I'm on episode, I just released episode 8 this morning. So it's a newbie. It's nascent phase. I love doing it. It's something that came up, probably a little over a year ago. I was having a conversation with a friend, who was kind of newly married, and she and her husband and I were talking about, kind of like figuring out how to, like, no one really gives you guidance on how to navigate, sharing the burden of like domestic life, financial, merging, even like, you know, cooking, cleaning, all that stuff. But also, we don't talk about it in sex. We don't talk about sharing labor. We don't talk about sex as labor within a relationship. We talk about it, you know, in terms of sex work and stuff, but, talking about, sharing the maybe emotional burden of maintaining boundaries, of getting consent, like all of that can be seen as a form of work and a practice that we can all get better at and be more communicative about. So that was kind of where the idea came from. And then now I've been talking to actors, comedians. I talked to a dominatrix. I talked to another intimacy coordinator. So it's a very kind of loose ongoing conversation about how we look at labor that isn't necessarily work that we get paid for. So kind of invisible forms of work that we don't necessarily look at as like, or we don't prioritize it because we have this relationship with money that sort of makes us think that, you know, if you're not getting paid for it, it's not really work.
Right. So it kind of follows the formula of emotional labor.
Exactly.
Okay. So before I let you go, there's the matter of the sexy story. Do you have a sexy, wild, or outrageous story that you'd like to share?
I was involved for a while with someone who was in an open marriage, and you know, it was all like above board, and his wife was totally fine. So like all of that was great. And this guy really wanted to be dominated, but didn't really know how to ask for it, and didn't know how to have like what I now understand to be kind of the ongoing practice of consent, or the communication style of consent. So it was a lot of kind of in the moment telling me to tell him what to do. And that, I find that to be an enormous amount of emotional labor that I don't really like. I would do for someone if it was kind of set out ahead of time, but it was always kind of in the moment, this like really pushy, you know, tell me what to do kind of thing. And all throughout the, this does get a little graphic, all throughout the relationship, like from very early on, he was, without asking, putting a dry finger up my butt when we were making out. And like the first time it happened, I was so shocked that I didn't say anything. And then the second time it happened, I was like, wow, really? This is just like, he just does that. That's so weird. And then I think it was the third time that it happened that I was like, hey, that's cool. I like that, but I need you to use lube. Like, and I don't care where you get it, like get lube from somewhere. And he seemed to hear me, but then it kept happening. It kept happening. He kept putting a dry finger up my butt, and no matter what I said. And so I started to feel like this is weird. Like, is he not hearing me? I couldn't figure it out. And then we actually hired a friend of mine who was a sex worker to come tell him what to do to me for an evening. And that was cool. I was excited about that idea, but I called up my friend and I was like, listen, he keeps putting a dry finger up my butt. I need your help. Like, please make sure he doesn't do that. And without getting into too much detail, she started to guide him through like making sure that his finger was very wet. And then she was going to have him do that. And he somehow like maneuvered himself to anyway put the dry finger up my butt. And I was like, I tried to do it so calmly. I was like, we have an audience. Like, I need to really be careful with this. So I reached down and I said, with this hand. And then he did it. And I was like, okay, success. Like, we got it. And then the next morning, he woke me up, and said, tell me what to do. Tell me what to do. You know, same thing. And I was like, oh my God, I'm like, I just woke up. I don't have the energy to do this. So I said, you know, can you do this? And he was like, don't ask, tell me. And I was like, oh my God, lie down. And I got on top of him. And then I swear to fucking God, this dude reached around and tried to stick a dry finger at my asshole. And I screamed at him. I fucking screamed at him. And I was like, lube. And in that moment, he said, I love it when you yell at me. And my heart sank. And I was like, oh my God, you have been doing this on purpose this whole time. You have been trying to piss me off because you want me to yell at you. And, you know, at the time I just was like, all right, I got to get out of it. Like we never slept together ever again. I just was like, I can't even deal with this. And it wasn't until recently when I started to understand the framework of the Wheel of Consent that I realized that he wanted to be in the allowing quadrant. He wanted me to take. And instead of making that agreement from the outset, he was manipulating me into giving him what he wanted because he didn't have the language or didn't feel that he would be able to get his needs met if he didn't kind of push me the way that he was. So that's my sexy story. It's not very sexy. It's actually like very infuriating, but
it's a good story though, because it does highlight the importance of setting up boundaries and consent ahead of time.
Right.
The communication around kinks and things like that is very important, independent of whether you're topping or bottoming or whatever you want, because clearly it wasn't that he wasn't listening. It was that he wanted something, right? And you might have consented and wanted to scream at him, but putting a dry finger up your ass was not the way you wanted that to happen.
No, I mean, you know, I could look at it, I could look back at it as like, clearly something non-consensual was going on. I never felt violated by it or anything like that, but, and I, you know, I don't feel traumatized by it and I can laugh at it. I think it's pretty fucking funny, but I also just think like, we got to be better than this. We got to do better than that.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. Before we end this interview, this is your chance to shout out all the places that people can find you, your social media, wherever you want to be found, plug away.
Okay. I am on Instagram at Mia Schachter, and my last name has two CHs in it. It's S-C-H-A-C-H-T-E-R. Mia is M-I-A. I'm barely on Twitter, but it's the same handle. And then I have Twitter and Instagram for my podcast, which is Share the Load Pod in both places. I do have a website if anyone wants to kind of read more about what it is that I do. It's sharetheloadinc.com. And I think that's everywhere.
Yeah.
So that's everywhere.
See your work, take your classes, hear your podcast. Yeah. You know where to go.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your
thank
time.
You.
It's been a wonderful and enlightening conversation.
Thank you.
You're listening to Intellectual Erection, a place where we talk about the naughty to stimulate your thinking.